Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. House Financial Services Committee Chair Barney Frank is expected to introduce legislation this week to curb dangerously large companies. He's calling it the real death panel. And Congress has gone from no public option in health care reform to debating different versions of one. The Senate may release its version of a plan as early as tomorrow. President Obama has his sixth meeting on Afghanistan today before he flies to speak with servicemen and women in Jacksonville, Florida. And former President George W. Bush is launching a speaking tour. His first appearance is tonight at a motivational seminar for salespeople. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News, author of ABC's blog, The Note. He's here to give us a preview. Rick, let's start with health care. You see a subtle but important shift, a move from if to when there's health care reform and a public option. And you say that drives Washington into a different mode?
Yes, I think you start getting into a compromise mode where politicians and interest groups decide where can we cut the best deal. Rather than saying this is going to be about outright opposition, you have a momentum and a tendency for lawmakers who are on the fence to say, okay, well, let me see what I can get because this train looks like it's leaving the station. That's getting most relevant right now with Senator Olympia Snowe, the Republican from Maine, who's been the only Republican willing to support the health care reform efforts, and she's basically still in the driver's seat. What she says is almost certainly going to be in that bill because of how important her vote is.
Well, but why the shift, as you hear it in the terrain? Because you quote people saying that the costs and the political calendar are catching up with health care reform. What does that mean?
I think what it means is that we're now at the end of October. This was supposed to be done before the August recess. We're nowhere close to being finished. We still don't have draft bills out of the House or the Senate. That could happen soon. But the sense of this having to happen before Christmas, before the end of the year, once you get into an election year, it's always more difficult. That's one difficulty. And the other thing is the cost. There's been several times where there's been sticker shock along the way, where people have seen new cost estimates out of the Congressional Budget Office, and it's, wow, where did that come from, and how are you going to pay for that? So those are the factors that have argued against this, but I think a couple of recent rounds of polling, including an ABC News Washington Post poll that suggested that there's growing support and strong support for a public option, that certainly helped, and I think this has a tendency to perpetuate itself. Once there's a decision in Washington that something is going to happen, that changes the mindset.
Well, and you said the momentum from the left, from President Obama and the Democrats, is that they need a win and they may settle for less than they originally wanted, maybe a weaker public insurance option. You quote Politico's David Rogers with that opinion. But the momentum from the right, you mentioned polling, and we're wondering if polling has something to do with this shift. George Stephanopoulos quoted the new ABC poll that shows only 20% of Americans call themselves Republicans. And when asked, who do you trust to take the country in the right direction, 49% said Obama. But Republican Senator Mitch McConnell came right back with a Gallup poll that showed that more people would vote for a Republican for Congress than would a year ago. Democrats are still ahead in that race, but not by as much. And I guess my question is, how are Republicans seeing themselves as viewed by the public, and how much is that motivating them on health care reform?
They think they're in the right. Clearly, they think that people are against President Obama's plans when they're fully explained. That's why they're not going along with them.
Even with this polling?
That's right. And the point they'll make back is, like, look, people are sick of Washington on both sides. And I think one big storyline of this year with the races, the gubernatorial races coming up next week even, are the rise of independents, people that don't identify with either party. These folks are up for grabs. I think there's a sense that over the next year, coming up into the 2010 midterm elections, that there's a big swath of voters that aren't necessarily Obama's, they aren't necessarily Republicans either.
Well, also this week, House Finance Services Committee Chair Barney Frank introducing this legislation that, as we said, he's calling the real death panel. It's also being compared to a living will for big business. Essentially, what would shift those companies into government hands if they get in trouble?
That's right. It would make it easier for the so-called too-big-to-fail companies to get overtaken by the government and overseen by the government to stop the financial collapse that we saw with these enormous financial institutions that had their tentacles into every area of government to try to correct that. It doesn't go nearly as far as a lot of folks want, but trying to strike a middle ground and trying to react also to the popular fervor that's out there and the anger that's out there over the huge bonuses, yeah, and the fact that we were taken to the brink by these enormous companies.
Then you have people like the New York Times' Jonah Serra saying it's the job of stockholders, shareholders, to keep companies in line. But we'll see that debate continue. Meanwhile, I just want to ask you briefly about George W. Bush's first speaking engagement. We haven't seen him in a while. He's going to be at a motivational seminar today. Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News is calling this the granddaddy of sales motivation seminars. It is, as you say, a well-trod path, but might Republicans be asking him not to be in public? Now, I'm just thinking of the, you know, that he's a reminder of Iraq and Afghanistan, and as these polls show, Republicans and falling out of favor.
Well, I don't think he's given a single policy speech, unlike Vice President Cheney, who's been out there pretty consistently criticizing President Obama. He's given President Obama lots of running room. Even the event that I was at in Toronto a few months ago, he was very careful not to criticize the administration in any way. I think he's respectful of that and realizes that his name politically probably isn't going to be very helpful to many Republicans.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of the ABC political blog, The Note, and obviously a busy guy. Rick, go answer your phone, and thank you.
All right, thanks.
Well, hopefully, if any legislation comes out of Washington this week, it will be in plain English so we can understand it, but also because that saves money. Did you know the VA saved $40,000 a year from rewriting just one standard letter? The Navy found that writing in plain English reduced reading time by between 17 and 23% and saved them almost $350 million per document. GE saved up to $500,000 a year in help desk staff costs because they rewrote a software manual. These statistics are from the British group, the Plain English Campaign. They've been waging war on confusing language in everything from airport signs to government policy documents, testifying before Parliament, actually getting government to change some documents. Christy Maher is founder of the 30-year-old Plain English Campaign. She joins us from Derbyshire, England. And Chrissy, a perfect example of what you do is a bill that you got from a bank. It talked about things like your maximum debit balance. You edited the bill and sent it back in plain English and replaced maximum debit balance with what?
It's the most that can be owed.
Well, we also know you have a glossary of financial terms that you find confusing and can rewrite. What, give us some of those.
Well, one of the things that I came across was something called CDOs. Collateralized debt obligations, which are really my commitment to repay a debt, which was secured on something I've got.
Give me some others.
I've got a before here with some examples of long-winded official writing.
Okay.
High-quality learning environments are a necessary precondition for facilitation and enhancement of the ongoing learning process. Mm. Right. And afterwards I think, well, what does that mean? I think, children need good schools if they're to learn properly. Now, why can't they say that?
Right.
Again, if you say, if there are any points on which you require explanation or further particulars, we'll be glad to furnish such additional details as may be required by telephone. But what they mean, if you've got any questions, why don't
call
you
call us?
You know.
Amazing. I'm looking at some of the others. Unlock clusters, subsidiarity, sector-specific benchmarking.
And that famous word, worklessness, which means people were just unemployed.
What is it?
But they call it by a fancy... Yeah, worklessness. They try and dress it up in a fancy frock, but people are still unemployed.
You wrote to Prime Minister Gordon Brown urging that Britain's Financial Services Authority establish standards of plain English and fine people if they don't use it. Would you really want to see banks fined?
Of course it would. You've got to be able to say, look, if I can go to court and I can prove that that sort of language, that sort of jargon and gobbledygook actually hindered me from making the right decision, then by my right, I feel that they should be heavily fined.
Do you think that unclear language is a big part of this financial crisis?
Yes, I certainly do. I think people have got themselves into trouble because, you know, if you want a mortgage, you're going to sign on the dotted line without ever being able to understand half the terminology that's in there. Well, I think that's gross because there's only one person who knows what's in that contract, and that's the lawyer who wrote it up. And the lawyer who wrote it up is a paid worker for whoever that contract belongs to. So they're going to have a vested interest in protecting their clients.
Yeah. I hear stories about people approaching you and having a real serious consequence of this. There's a 16-year-old who wanted to open a checking account, but...
Yes, he did. He just earned his first pay packet. And he said all this material that he'd been given from the bank. He didn't understand a word of it. Now, if we're not getting the youngsters in on the banking system's going to die.
He couldn't understand the AER, which is the annual equivalent rate and interest rate with annual compound interest. Well, I'm glad...
They defined
that. You have given out awards for the worst examples of jargon, and we're reminded it's much wider than the financial business.
It is.
This is your golden bull, and you awarded Gatwick Airport for a sign.
That was for shoes. I think it was a shoe repatriation area.
The passenger shoe repatriation area. I think it was an area where passengers got their shoes after, you know, going through security. But why wouldn't they just say, retrieve your shoes here?
Well, that's right. Come and get your shoes back.
How did you come to this?
Well, I didn't learn to read and write till I was 15 years old. We came from a big Liverpool Irish family, and there was lots of us, and my dad died very early from a heart attack in the Second World War. And, of course, you grow up not going to school because you've got no clothes to go in. We just spend your life in the field, really. And then when I got older, I suddenly realised that we didn't have very good books in the library. You couldn't join the library because you couldn't read the jargon on the slip that they give you to invite you to join anyway. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, somebody's got to do something about this.
How isolating did that feel, not to understand?
Well, everywhere's a 10-foot wall to me because I couldn't travel. It was trams then, not buses. And we used to get on the tram and wait to see if it went the right way. And if it didn't, you have to get off and get on another one because you couldn't find your way around. It was like being in a foreign country and not speaking the language. But when I did learn to read and write, I went to night school. I suddenly realised that hadn't all been my fault. Some of the fault had lay with the people who were writing to me, that notices up on walls or newspapers. So I decided I would do something about it. I can see people around me dying because they can't fill in forms for heating allowance. I sat with a man with 7 children about to be evicted. He had a letter that was in red and he'd come to me, knew it was danger, but he couldn't read it. So I told him he was about to be put out on the sidewalk. And only to find out that when I'd read the letter, that there was no need for him to be evicted in the first place. The housing department hadn't paid over the money to another department. He'd been paying, and he'd been evicted through no fault of his own. You know, this shouldn't happen because of words. You know, I was talking to a lady the other day where she'd actually fed the kids. She said with the medicine that it said 3 times a day. But what the doctor had meant was a dose every 8 hours. Well, she broke her waking day into 3 and, in fact, gave it the child every 4 hours. Mm. But you see how dangerous it can be. It can become a matter of life and death.
Well, and you started your campaign in 1979, and now it's not just people who can't read, it's that even people who are well-educated can't understand. You have had some luck. You had a campaign in the 80s. You got your government there to rewrite thousands of forms. Do you think you'll make some headway in the financial world?
I certainly hope so. I really do hope so. And I mean, in that way, people's confidence is back with them. They can take the responsibility for their debts or their overdraft or their loans with confidence because they know what they've signed for. If they fall foul of that, they can only blame themselves.
That's Chrissy Maher, founder of the Plain English Campaign, campaigning for clear language in everything from airport signs to banking documents. Chrissy, thanks so much for talking to us about it, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much indeed. It's lovely talking to you.
All right. This quick note coming up this week, wellness benefits programs. Do they push people to take better care of themselves or punish them for health issues they can't control? Also, a loving tribute to the late actor many people only know as Fredo in The Godfather, John Cazale. That's coming up later this week. We'll be back in 1 minute with Anthony Shadid in Baghdad, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. When General David Petraeus was asked if he thought yesterday's twin suicide car bombs in Baghdad will prompt Iraqis to ask for American troops to return to the cities, Petraeus said no, Iraqis will respond to this. But can they, and can they in time for the scheduled January parliamentary election? Petraeus spoke as he flew over Baghdad with Washington Post reporter David Ignatius. Also in Baghdad, back on the ground, David's colleague Anthony Shadid, who joins us now from the NPR studios. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you.
And yesterday's bombing left quite a swath of destruction. 2 government buildings destroyed, more than 150 people killed. You were there in the aftermath. So how, first of all, are Iraqis coping today?
Well, I think there's a sense of shock just over the scale of the destruction. It was, you know, in 7 years here, it was carnage unlike I've seen since 2003. There is a sense of frustration, a sense of fear, a sense of anxiety over what's coming next. And I think there's a sense that the elections themselves are introducing a dynamic into Iraq that could become more violent as we go forward. You know, I think there's a conception often, maybe in the States, that there have been rules imposed in this country and people are going to play by the rules. That's not necessarily the case in politics. And I think there is a deep fear here that, that violence may escalate as we get closer toward that, that ballot on January 16th.
And yet your colleague, David Ignatius, writes that he's astonished at how many Iraqis seem to just get up and get going after the attacks, many of them positive in spirit. One wondering in a conversation about problems with this upcoming election, but then saying, wow, we have the freedom to talk about this. You, on the other hand, you know, you're down in this horrible area where these twin car bombs went off, and you meet an Iraqi whose relative had been killed, and he just says, just such a simple sentence, all Iraqis will die. Which mood do you think better represents the city?
You know, I don't think there's any question that, that Baghdad is probably one of the most resilient cities in the world. Life manages to go on here, and there's no question about that. But I think we often maybe lose an appreciation for how tattered the society's fabric actually is after all these years. And, you know, I think among American officials, there's a linear sense of where things are going. Violence is going down. We're going to have elections. A new government will be seated, and the United States will withdraw. I'm not sure things are going to proceed in a linear fashion here. I think it may be much more precarious. I think it may be much more unexpected. And I think this violence that we saw yesterday is an example of that.
Well, you say tattered. We're looking at buildings that, you know, several story high buildings completely tattered. There was a similar bombing in August. So now I think a total of five government buildings are just reduced to rubble. And his many critics say Prime Minister Maliki was way too lax in security, taking down blast walls, etc., you know, before maybe they should have been. So given that you say that you think there's going to a sense that there's going to be even more violence, what's happening today to either reverse that or address that?
Well, I think you hit on a good point, and that's frustration over Prime Minister Maliki's government. You know, what struck me about yesterday's attack was that, you know, it wasn't like the explosions we've had in the past, explosions that were detonated at restaurants, at markets. Those attacks were often just meant to ignite sectarian carnage, sectarian strife. Yesterday's had a very distinct political logic, and that was to show that Prime Minister Maliki's government cannot secure the capital, basically its seat of authority. And they did that to a certain extent. I mean, when you talk to people at the scene afterwards, that was definitely what they were saying.
Well, and we should say that these cars both had to go through several government-run checkpoints to get where they were.
Absolutely. And I think that's you heard that time and again yesterday at the scene. How could you have so many checkpoints and still have violations of these checkpoints? In fact, one person said it in those words to me, the more checkpoints we have, the more violations we have. I think what yesterday's attack showed is that insurgents and whoever these insurgents were, you know, still possess a very, you know, a pretty remarkable prowess in carrying out these attacks. These were not easy targets. They were fortified. They were behind blast walls. And twice in 2 months, they've managed to pull them off. You know, perhaps the aftermath of the attacks are as important as the attacks themselves. What they're doing is wrecking pillars of the state's authority. And that'll have reverberations, I think, for weeks and months to come.
Well, they're also killing women and children. We understand one of the buildings, it was filled with women and children waiting to get some sort of compensation because of a previous bombing. And people saw bodies split, fly in the air. You spoke to people who saw this. Isn't this going to backfire on these insurgents?
You know, is there going to be a backlash? I think that's tough to say. I mean, how much violence this country has had to endure. You know, when you looked at faces at the scene yesterday, walking across the bridge toward the provincial headquarters, toward the ministries, you know, it was more than a faraway look. It was almost a numbed look. And you heard that same sentiment, I think, in conversations with people. It's just, you know, this is our destiny. This is our fate. This is how Iraq is.
Well, you said whoever did this. Is there a sense of who did it? I know Maliki says that it's followers of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist Party and al-Qaeda. Is there a sense that it's that or, you know, Sunnis who are upset with the Shiite-dominated government?
You know, after August's attack, Prime Minister Maliki accused Ba'athist, basically, and he later broadened that to include al-Qaeda. I think a lot of people thought he overreached on that he was playing politics. The Americans were very clear that they did not think it was remnants of the Ba'ath Party. They thought it was al-Qaeda. I think that's going to be the same assumption in this attack, but I think there's a lot of uncertainty about who is exactly behind these attacks.
Well, you know, I hate to ask you to speculate, but I'm going to. We started by saying General Petraeus said that he didn't think that this was going to lead to Iraqis asking the U.S. troops to stay after the scheduled pullout in the summer. Do you think he's right?
You know, I think it's very clear from this administration that this is not their war. And it's hard for me to imagine how much of an increase in violence we'd have to see for the administration to reverse course and send troops back in here. I mean, I think withdrawal is pretty much a done deal. What kind of conditions are taking place as that withdrawal happens is another question. And I think it's very possible we could see more violence, even dramatic violence, in the run-up to the election. And then you have a very precarious 6 or 7 months after the election in which you try to form a government. And that in itself is going to be a dangerous game as well.
Anthony Shadid, Washington Post foreign correspondent. He is in Baghdad at the NPR studios there. Anthony, thank you so much for giving us some time today.
My pleasure.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. Still ahead today, the cinematic sounds of Patrick Watson and the Wooden Arms. He doesn't have wooden arms. That's the name of his band. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. Welcome back to Here and Now. The judges in the war crimes trial of Radovan Karadzic are vowing the trial will begin tomorrow with or without the former Bosnian Serb leader, and it might just be without. The trial was scheduled to begin today at The Hague, but Karadzic refused to leave his cell, claiming he hasn't had enough time to prepare for the trial since his arrest in July 2008. He is one of the central figures from the Balkan War triggered by the breakup of Yugoslavia. The indictment against him includes the 1995 massacre at Srebrenica, where thousands of Muslim men and boys were slaughtered by Serb forces despite the presence of Dutch peacekeepers. The BBC's Alan Little went to Srebrenica recently to talk to people about the Karadzic trial, and Alan prepared this report.
At Srebrenica, the damp Bosnian earth is still yielding evidence. Carefully, a mechanical digger is scraping a little slit trench, probing the soil for more bodies of those who died. This is perhaps the darkest episode of Bosnia's war. 8,000 Muslim men and boys were murdered here in the space of 5 days when the Bosnian Serb army seized the Muslim-populated enclave. This is the site of the old battery factory where the Dutch battalion set up their headquarters. And if we go inside here, we come into one of the vast hangars where people turned up in those crucial days in the middle of July 1995, seeking refuge. And people came here because they believed that they would be safe. In fact, this place, teeming with thousands of terrified people, turned out to be simply a kind of waiting room for the massacre. Among the people who came here seeking safety was Shahida Abdurakhmanovic.
I spent 2 nights in this hole with my daughter. Whenever I come back to this empty factory, I hear again the screams. I see the wounded people, the horrifying scene.
Can I ask you about the trial of Radovan Karadzic? Why do you think it's important?
All of the war criminals are important, but we believe it was Karadzic who was behind this, who gave the orders to commit mass murder and ethnically cleanse the country.
At the church on the hill above Srebrenica town centre, local Serbs are celebrating an Orthodox Christian holy day. They sit around an enormous table eating grilled meat and bean stew and drinking homemade plum brandy. Outside, the young men gather with beer and cigarettes and sing to the deafening beat of a backing track, a song to the glory of Radovan Karadzic. Where are you, Brother Radovan? The song says, the Serbian homeland will never give you up. And they blast the music out on loudspeakers, and the sound of it carries through the streets of a town now synonymous with mass murder. I asked the host of the celebration, Nedjo Kujic, whether he thought Radovan Karadzic was guilty.
Well, you know what? That's for the court in The Hague to decide.
And do you think that this community has recovered from, moved on from, the massacre that happened here in 1995?
And there was one in 1992. People only talk about what happened in 95. But in 1992, Serb villages here were burnt down and the people were killed. There were lots of victims on our side as well. Serbs and Muslims were all victims.
Bosnia is a land of parallel truths. Serbian public opinion has never accepted that war crimes were committed in the name of the Serbian people. Many here deny the Srebrenica massacre even occurred. The evidence, though, is all around. The charge is that about 1,000 of the men and boys rounded up at Srebrenica were brought here to this shabby, run-down concrete warehouse just up the road. And if you go inside, you can see what kind of a place it is. There are windows about 6 or 7 feet from the ground, and you can see that once you're inside here, all you've got is concrete walls and those few windows, so there's no escape. The accusation is that the gunmen stood here by the door and opened fire after throwing grenades. Only a handful of the 1,000 who were herded in here survived. You can still see the bullet holes in the walls beneath the windows.
That report from the BBC's Alan Little. Earlier today, we quoted George Stephanopoulos citing a new ABC poll that shows only 20% of Americans call themselves Republicans and only 19% say they trusted congressional Republicans. But his guest, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, responded to Stephanopoulos that at least one Democrat in Virginia was distancing himself from President Obama. Residents in Virginia and New Jersey choose a new governor next week, and despite those polls about Republicans, Virginia is being seen as a litmus test on the Obama presidency. Let's start there. Anita Kumar is covering the Virginia race for The Washington Post. Anita, Virginia has Republican and former State Attorney General Bob McDonnell facing the Democrat that Mitch McConnell was talking about. That's Cree Deeds, a former state senator. How is each man trying to cast the race?
Bob McDonnell, who's the Republican, is talking a lot about jobs and the economy. He's also talked a lot about national issues. He realizes, smartly so, that the national mood is really favoring Republicans right now.
You say the national mood, but we see the polls where the Republicans seem to be plummeting.
Right. I've seen those polls, too, and I find that interesting because even in our own Washington Post polls in the last few months, we've seen that in Virginia, the atmosphere for Republicans is better than it has been. More people are aligning themselves with the party, and more people, in every poll, Bob McDonnell has been leading. And so more people are embracing the Republican Party than not in the state.
Well, as you say, McDonnell trying to tie the Democrat Deeds to programs coming out of Washington. Deeds backers have been trying to tie McDonnell to his more conservative past. As a grad student 20 years ago, he wrote that working women, feminists, and homosexuals were detrimental to the family. But that doesn't seem to be working from the Deeds side. How is Deeds trying to craft himself?
He's talked a lot about education. He has a commercial out on that. He has also talked about jobs in the economy, transportation. But yes, a lot of his time has been spent on talking about Bob McDonnell and this thesis that you mentioned from 20 years ago, very conservative views in there that actually Bob McDonnell has said about some of them, well, I've changed my mind.
Well, Virginia has typically been a red state. Lately, it looked a little bluer when Barack Obama carried it last year. It was the first Democratic presidential candidate to do that since Lyndon Johnson in 64.
Right.
And Democrats have won the last two governor's races, but we know in the last 8 gubernatorial elections in Virginia, the party of the president has always lost the year after he was elected. So is this perhaps just following that formula, or do you think there's something more going on?
I think that what you mentioned about the White House is really important. This and New Jersey are the first significant races after a presidential race, and you can always feel sort of a backlash no matter how popular the person going in. Barack Obama, very popular going in. There's always sort of some anxiety about, is the president going far enough? Is he not going far enough? And it sort of reverberates every 4 years in Virginia.
Well, Jim Margolis, who's a former senior advisor to Obama's presidential campaign, is quoted in the Los Angeles Times as saying he'd advise Obama now to stay away from both Virginia and New Jersey, to focus his energy on other things, pointing to something that the paper's calling Obama hangover, you know, that the left just doesn't have the anger and the motivation that the right has in this campaign.
Well, that's interesting. Obama is actually in Virginia tomorrow, so this will be his second rally with Creed Eads. There have been a lot of people questioning in the last couple weeks if Creed Eads did the opposite, if he pushed Obama away when he should have actually embraced him to get some of that enthusiasm back.
Anita Kumar of The Washington Post. Anita, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
Well, now let's turn to that other governor's race in New Jersey. This one not seen as a referendum on Obama as much as one that focuses on local issues from jobs to driving records. Democratic incumbent Governor John Corzine is facing Republican former U.S. Attorney Chris Christie. There's also an independent former Republican Chris Daggett. Tom Moran is columnist for the Star-Ledger in New Jersey. Tom, start with Corzine. How's he campaigning?
Corzine is the sort of classic liberal. He's expanded health care and preschool and that sort of thing even during tough times. He's presenting himself also, being a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, he's presenting himself as an economic manager, and that is his trouble.
Yeah.
Unemployment is rising fast. We have among the highest taxes in the country. And when he took over, New Jersey had lower unemployment than the neighboring states. Now it has equal or higher.
Well, it's also to his disadvantage to be from Goldman Sachs, given what's happened to Wall Street.
Yeah, it's lost its luster.
Chris Christie?
Chris Christie has been the state's U.S. attorney in Newark for the last 7 years and has done a great job, threw about 130 corrupt politicians in jail. He's basically running as the anti-Corzine and as a decisive leader.
Well, let's stay with those two for a second, because in July there was a huge corruption scandal in your state. Close allies of the governor were arrested. A member of his cabinet resigned. A Democratic consultant committed suicide. This would all seem to just hand issues to Christie. But Corzine seemed to hold on. Why? What did he do?
Well, when you look at polls and you ask people, do you consider corruption a serious problem in New Jersey, about 70% of people say yes. But when you ask them what's the most important issue, they say property taxes, they say jobs, they say health care. Corruption turns up at only 4%. So even though that July series of arrests, I think it was 44 people, and it was outrageous, even though that happened, it did give Christie a bump at the time. It didn't seem to have lasting power.
Well, and Corzine, we understand, also tried to paint Christie as someone who was close to George W. Bush and Karl Rove. Has that worked?
I think so. To some degree, it's a fair connection. Bush appointed him because Christie had raised a lot of money for Bush in the first place. Plus, Christie has said his first priority when he gets into office will be to reduce taxes on households making more than $400,000 a year.
It's being brought up that Christie hit a motorcyclist while driving the wrong way down a one-way street, and he got out of it.
He apparently told the investigating officer that he was U.S. attorney and received no ticket. So the Corzine campaign has been running a bunch of ads saying, what would happen to you if you crashed into a motorcycle going the wrong way?
Of course, that's risky for the Corzine ad to draw attention to problems with driving, because, of course, he had that situation a couple years ago where his police detail was speeding, there was an accident, he didn't have a seatbelt on.
Right. They're going about 90 miles an hour. The governor was almost killed.
So maybe they cancel each other out on that issue. But what about the ad that Governor Corzine's side put out that seemed to be making fun of Chris Christie's weight?
Right. It's an ad that includes that car crash, and it says he's been throwing his weight around.
The Corzine people claim they weren't making fun of his weight.
That's nonsense. The camera angles and the slow-mo as he's climbing out of his car, it's clearly intending to point out to people that he's way overweight.
Is that going to work, or is that going to backfire on Corzine?
You know, I think it'll backfire, because Christie has handled it so well. He's basically said, look, I'm up and down 30, 40 pounds. This is something I struggle with, and it's no secret. And look at how desperate the governor is to focus on my girth instead of property taxes.
And just briefly, tell us about former Republican Chris Daggett, who's running as an independent.
He's actually making a very strong showing. One poll recently had him at 20%. He's come up with a plan to really change New Jersey fundamentally by shifting the tax burden from the property tax to the sales tax somewhat. So he's gotten a lot of attention because he's the only one saying how he will solve the biggest problem in the state by every poll.
Tom Moran, columnist for the Star-Ledger in New Jersey. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, take a break. When we come back, the lovely sounds of Canadian Patrick Watson, sounds that sometimes come from pots, pans, and tree branches. That's in a minute. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back.
I wish I'd be in your world and arms has swallowed me into a thousand dreams.
The ethereal voice of Canadian singer-songwriter Patrick Watson. The tune, Wooden Arms, is the title track on his latest CD and also the name of his band. Wooden Arms is Watson's follow-up to Close to Paradise, which won the prestigious 2007 Polaris Prize, Canada's equivalent of the Album of the Year, for its textured, somewhat experimental soundscapes. And Patrick Watson joins us from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC, in Montreal. Patrick, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Well, we just want to get quickly to one of our favorite tracks on the CD, also timely, because we understand it was inspired by one of our favorite authors and yours as well. This is a song you wrote for Where the Wild Things Are?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I grew up with that book almost every day, so I feel when I found out Spike Jonze was doing the film, I was like, oh, well, it would probably be my dream job out of any job I'd ever have to score the film. So I said, well, I'll just do a song anyways, and I'll send it to him. You know, that's why I had to do the song. And I think probably loosely based it on touring lyrically. So.
Well, first of all, let's listen to a little of Patrick Watson's Maurice Sendak-inspired Where the Wild Things Are. I take a chasing me all day long. But I ain't afraid. I know where the wild things are. Well, okay, questions. Did you hear back from Spike Jonze when you sent that song to him?
Not from Spike Jonze, but from the film studios replied. I mean, I think he had a pretty strong idea of what he wanted musically before he even made the film.
And tie the wild things to touring, because you said that you kind of wrote the song about where the wild things are and touring.
Well, I think the joke is that, you know, when you go out on the road and you start touring, you're like, it's kind of like just like the book, when you get in the boat, you're all excited. He becomes a king of the island, and he does all his crazy things, and at the end, he just gets really homesick. And he comes home, and his mom's cooked him his hot dinner, and he's all happy to get home. So I think it's a way of looking at touring. It often makes me think of that book.
Well, it wouldn't be unusual for you to write a song for a soundtrack. You've composed a number of film scores. Your first recording project was an experimental effort to accompany a book of underwater photography. And your instrumentation is inventive, to say the least. What is your percussionist, Robbie Custer, playing on the song Wooden Arms?
You know, that was just pots and pans, and I think there was a tree involved. I mean,
a tree branch.
Yeah, but I think I was going to give it that kind of vinyl sound you hear, like, shh, in the background a bit. It's very subtle in the mix. The thing is that when I think Robbie was going through a period where he was, like, you know, he's someone who's played drums all his life. He's a very, like, well-accomplished jazz musician, jazz drummer. And I think he just needed a break from the drums. So he started really kind of going out and just trying different percussion just to keep himself happy and have fun, you know. And that was definitely one of the moments where, you know, you went to the kitchen and got some stuff and then let's go.
We understand on other tracks you use a toilet plunger, there's sliding drawers, and on the song Beijing you play a bicycle. Let's listen to a little of that. So how do you play a bicycle? What parts?
When it comes to these type of orchestrations, we kind of got inspired by a lot of cartoon music. In the instrumentation, sometimes they would pop in a couple of real sounds in, or like, you know, Foley sounds, as we would call them. So we want to give a feeling of a bike chase near the, like, the for that whole drum breakdown.
Thank you.
you're going to want to do something a bit out of the regular necessarily, I think you have to put a little extra effort into being narrative and making sure that you're telling a story still. So I think those type of orchestrations in there would give a little humor and help tell the story.
Because this is, after all, Beijing, and the Chinese capital is filled with bicycles.
Well, I think whenever you travel in Asia, it's probably the thing that really marks you the most in general. The hundreds and hundreds of bicycles, just like it's just an amazing thing to see, I think, when you go to Asia. It's definitely something that's remarkable when you're there.
Well, and we understand A Visit to Asia was half the inspiration for another of your songs, Big Bird in a Small Cage. But the rest of the inspiration came during a performance in New Orleans. Tell us a little more about that song.
The original story came, I was at a musician's house in Vietnam, actually, and there was a musicians for the whole generations back, like, so their walls are filled with pictures of their great-grandfather's musicians, and they also had this incredible collection of, like, birds and songbirds. And there was this one kind of cage in the corner that was, like, a smaller cage with, like, a drape over top of it. And then when I lifted up the drape, there's this huge bird, like, sitting in the small cage. And I'm like, well, that's kind of weird. Why would you put the biggest bird in the small cage? And he goes, well, if you put the big bird in a small cage, he sings. And it's just something that kind of just hit me. It was years ago, too. And I said, well, one day, how can you not write a song with a story like that? You know, it's kind of like in the bag type of thing. And I had it on the shelf for a while, and I knew I always wanted to write a song about that. And then we were traveling in New Orleans. We ended up at this small little bar, I think, in the middle of the night, and it kind of just made me think about that story in Asia. And it was a small little blues bar, but all the little tiny places, it just seems like the musicians were just like, you know, it's like when you play also shows in a small place, sometimes they're always the most amazing shows, and in small places you just want to feel the, you know, do you know what I mean?
Well, we're rolling the town in the sweet New Orleans to the Apple Bell Bar. There's a hole in the wall, the ceilings were all the floors of the crime, but the sound that you would make would just warm your heart. Well, it's 11:45 when the boys walked in. They got their black suits on and the songs would begin. You open up your ears and hearts. You put a big bird in a small cage and sing you a song.
That's Big Bird in a Small Cage from Canadian singer-songwriter Patrick Watson. His latest CD is Wooden Arms, which is also the name of his band. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. We want to go out with the instrumental track Hommage. Hommage with two M's, because, again, Patrick's home is Montreal. French spelling. But Patrick, an homage to anyone in particular?
A drummer's friend who had passed away, that's why it was called Hommage.
Great. Patrick, thanks so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure talking to you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week brings here and now.